is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Thursday, May 21st, 2020. Producing from his home studio, the elaborate studio of Taylor Schwenk, working from home. I'm Buster Olney. I'm working from my home studio just north of New York City. Today, as we continue Coaches Week, we'll be talking with the Padres' Wayne Kirby, who worked for years as a coach of the Baltimore Orioles. And he confirms a story about how Albert Bell got his nickname, explains how he and longtime outfielder Adam Jones constantly argued, and relates what it was like to play against a Hall of Fame football player in high school. One word, pain. Wayne Kirby, of course, now with the San Diego Padres. We'll also be talking with Marley Rivera. Before we do that, some news and notes. The sports world remains shut down, but the Astros third baseman Alex Bregman has changed agents because his former agent, Brody Schofield, the one he just let go, worked in an organization led by LeBron James that's going to produce a docuseries on the Astros sign-stealing scandal. We'll be talking about that with Marley. Jesse Rogers is a story today on ESPN.com about how some players would like to see some tweaks to the medical protocol that have been put forth by Major League Baseball. He spoke with Paul DeJong, the shortstop for the St. Louis Cardinals. The quote from Paul: "The daily testing I'm a fan of to quickly determine our status every day. But given that, I'd like to see the freedom operating in the clubhouse and on the field." He also said there are a lot of good ideas. There were a lot of rules and infrastructure to get in place and enforce. We'll find the right mix. We can pull this off. Brandon Kintzer of the Marlins said, "Not getting to use any of the facilities that help recover our bodies is going to be a problem." One player who requested an anonymity from Jesse asked, "If we all test negative, why do we have to use separate baseballs?" That's part of the protocol, of course. The Tampa Bay Rays are taking the initial and small step toward returning to action, opening Tropicana Field on Monday for limited and mostly individual player workouts. I've heard that also is going to be something in place for other teams. Now, before we get to Wayne Kirby and Marley, check out the latest edition of the Adam Schefter podcast. This week, Adam is joined by Steelers running back James Conner, who talks about training in the quarantine, expectations for this upcoming season, and his new book. Then we hear from Dr. Tom Mayer, who says players may be recommended new helmets and face masks for this upcoming season that would help prevent the spread of COVID-19. Find it wherever you get your podcast. Marley Rivera covers baseball for ESPN. And Marley, I just mentioned at the top about Alex Bregman's decision to fire his agent, Brody Schofield. This after we got word the LeBron James's group is beginning work, or at least sort of painting broad strokes on doing some sort of a documentary treatment on the Houston Astros sign-stealing scandal. So from Alex Bregman's perspective, you know, his agent is someone who's in that group, and I'm sure he was like, "Hey, what are you doing?"
Well, absolutely. I mean, your agent is always supposed to be in your favor, right? To work for you, to get your image out there, to get you more money, you know, to really work on that. So certainly if I'm Alex Bregman, I understand his perspective. I mean, we're supposed to all be, you know, together in this, and you are part of a group that is producing a documentary that can be detrimental to my image. So, I mean, I completely understand his decision.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting there, well, there are actually a couple of interesting things about this. We just saw The Last Dance, in which basically everybody except for Karl Malone sat down for that documentary about Michael Jordan. I don't think they'll be able to get all the Astros players to do sit-down interviews for a documentary anytime soon. And I also, in LeBron James's group, and this doesn't mean that he necessarily is going to have a hand in this, is CC Sabathia, course, the former Yankee pitcher who's been pretty outspoken about it.
Absolutely. Not only that, CeCe never shied away from putting his opinion out there, right, Buster, to put it mildly. He always was one of those great statesmen in the Yankees who always stood up for what he believed was right. And it's going to be interesting if in any way, you know, we obviously don't know how much involvement Sabathia is going to have this. But I do know that CeCe really wants to go into production, really wants to go into media. It is, you know, we know how popular his podcast is. And it is something that I can see him being involved in because, I mean, CeCe was not a fan of the Astros sign-stealing scandal. So it'll be interesting to see how involved he gets on this I don't know if it's going to be against Alex Bregman, but certainly against the Astros.
Yeah, as we sit here today, I think there's a good chance that CeCe Sabathia will sit for an interview and a lot of the Astros won't. an observation about Alex Bregman. I'll say this, that it's been interesting to sort of see the, you know, how the Astros players have handled this. You and I talked early on when there were first conversations among Astros players out loud about this, and I felt like, you know, they're never going to convince people of what they want to convince them, so they might as well just move on. I feel like, to some degree, that's what Alex has done. Like, I follow him on social media. He has spent a lot of time doing charitable works and focusing on charitable works. And, of course, you know, I'll look at the mentions after that when he'll post something about a project that he has to raise money. And so many of the mentions are, oh, you're a cheater. Did someone bang on a trash can and all that stuff? But I almost feel like he's putting blinders on. He's saying, you know, what happened in the past is what it is. I'm just going to try to help people as much as I possibly can. And you know what? That's the right thing to do.
Absolutely, Buster. My experience was the same with Carlos Correa when we did our interview for ESPN. The comment, you know, in the interview was constantly about, well, you know, all the charity work that he was doing too, along with Alex Bregman, and all the, you know, the work was like, did you sell your World Series ring, you know, to donate the money and this kind of stuff. But I'm going to say something. These kids are 26 years old. Right?
Yep.
And they had success very, very early on. When I first met Alex Bregman, the Alex Bregman that I knew at that time when he first debuted in Major League Baseball was one of the kindest, most jovial, you know, kids with this passion for the game. And I loved being around him. And I saw him lose that the last couple of years. I'll say it, and this is my personal opinion. It seemed to me like it went to his head. And it is one of those things that now see him do this. You know what? It's a lesson from the Astros sign stealing scandal. You're going to do more charity work, and you're going to be a better person, then you know what? It was all worth it then.
Well, and we, as you say, he's in his mid-20s. It's not like, and he's a super smart guy. It's not like he's incapable of change, you know?
Absolutely. I don't want to be judged by the way I behaved when I was in my early 20s. Let's be very clear.
Yeah, me neither. That's for sure. All right, let's get to the 67-page protocol that came out last weekend. What's your sense of where we stand in that conversation?
I had some takes from players this week that were interesting, Buster. The author's right, it's the extensive details on health and safety. But one of the things that a couple of players mentioned was the reduced staffing that is going to be in there. And I found that interesting. For example, as you well know, you know, we used to talk to David Ortiz in his last year with the Boston Red Sox, and his line was, I spent 3 hours at the trainer's room right before first pitch, right, in order to be able to be out there. And according to the document, there's a very reduced amount of trainers. And players, I know it sounds banal, but players are creatures of habit, and they need, you know, their rollouts, and their stretching, and their massage, and they're really concerned about not having access to the right amount of, you know, training and routine that they're used to, and they're concerned about injury. I found that really interesting. And another detail was that it was so specific about social distancing rules in stadiums. And one of the things that one player said from the AL said, not all stadiums are created equal. So it's not the same thing playing at Yankee Stadium that at the Coliseum in Oakland. So they just don't see that. They don't see how there can be any symmetry in social distancing rules and fairness if you're playing in different cities. Of course, you know, they're also, so all the details about health and safety, they all thought it was really burdensome. One player directly said, when I read it, I thought, you got to be kidding me. So it's really, you know, they're all at this point thinking, this is necessary. We understand it, but they really don't see it implemented. They don't know how it can be implemented.
I thought our colleague Pedro Gomez did a great piece on Carlos Carrasco, the pitcher for the Indians.
Yes.
Who last year, of course, was diagnosed with and treated for leukemia. And that interview made me cringe, Marley. And I love Carlos. I mean, you know, Cookie's a great guy. Always enjoyed talking with him. But when he basically was saying, if there's baseball, I'm going to be back on the field, I felt like yelling out, no, no, no. Whatever your doctors say, please listen to that. How did you feel watching that interview?
Absolutely. It was one of those things. And like you said, I mean, Cookie Carrasco, Roberto Clemente Award nominee, right? Like the kind of work that he's done, not only with charity, with his family, but just everything that he's done in the city of Cleveland. And this is a guy that we all rooted for, right? He's one of those true good guys in the game. But I just think that we have to be careful with our priorities at times. And this is a guy that is very lucky to be alive, we'll say it, and to be healthy. We're very happy for that. And I think it should be really a concern for him. He is in that kind of danger population that if affected by the virus, hopefully that will never happen. You know, it could be a complication for him. So, yes, I felt the same way, that maybe he needs to, you know, not take it more seriously, but be a little bit more concerned about it. Because I do think he's taking it seriously. But there's some concerns that I have that it seems that he doesn't have. But you know what? He's the one who has to be out there, Buster. So, but I appreciate what a great piece and what great work that our colleague Pedro Gomez.
Yeah, and look, this deal is already so complicated. I hope that one of the complications they can work out is when it comes to players like Carrasco, make exceptions for those guys and say, you know, even if they don't participate, they could still get paid. In other words, take that pressure off him. In some respects, take the decision out of their hands. If the medical experts say it's better for him not to be on the field, then you know, hopefully they could find a way where he would get credit, you know, not only for time served, he's going to get that, but also for money earned. It's best for everybody if you keep him as safe as possible. You and I think, have the same sense of pessimism about whether or not they can actually pull this all together. In recent days, I've had conversations with moderates among the agents and among the players, and they still think that eventually a deal does get struck and that there will be an opportunity at some point to play. But it just feels like there's so many potential tripwires, you know, where this doesn't all work out. What's your sense of where we stand with all this?
The exact same thing. It's almost like in the beginning, and it's interesting just from my personal perspective, when we first started dealing with the pandemic and how it affected baseball, which obviously is a very, very low priority in the, you know, in the worldwide view of what we're going through. But at that time, I was the ringleader of rooting for baseball to come back. I was all about, every time a player would call me or an executive I would talk to, I was the one who reassured them constantly. I believe there's going to be baseball. Now the tables have turned. And it really has been me, and maybe it comes from living in New York City and experiencing the pandemic firsthand the way we have in this city. It's me that doesn't see it, that I can't see a path. And it is them saying exactly what you said. The moderates, especially, you know, among both sides of the, you know, of the table here, they're saying, yes, we see it. And I think in the end, Buster, it will happen because it will boil down to economics, unfortunately, right? It is going to be like making 10% of what you would have made is better than making nothing. And that's sort of how I see it. They do see it as hopeful. And one little thing, what you mentioned with Carrasco, couldn't agree with you more that he should get the service time and take that pressure off. But I also believe that it should be like that for any player. Any player who's a 40-man roster, you know, who would have been maybe, you know, a 25-man roster guy who decides that he doesn't want to take the risk for reasons, whatever they are, you know, I do believe that they should have that choice of not being out there.
Are you as, I'm trying to think of the perfect word, frustrated is not not a perfect word, maybe shocked. Are you as shocked that this has come spilling out into this public debate over money in the way that it has? Because at the beginning of this, I was just kind of quietly thinking, boy, they can't let that happen. Boy, they can't let that happen. And then Tony Clark put out statements. Scott Boras, you know, was very public out loud. You know, he wrote that op-ed that was in New York Times. You had Blake Snell say what he said. And then on the owner's side, you had them leaking out information, which obviously could be interpreted as trying to pressure the players into making a deal. I'm just shocked that we're in this place where the perception of casual fans is that this has become a big argument over money.
Absolutely, Buster. And I'm on the record, right? All the fans out there know, who read me or listen to me or watch me, know that I'm pro player, right? I've always been on the record on the player side very often and so on. But this has been surprising to me how public it has been, because it's bringing back that 1994 argument of billionaires versus millionaires, right? And it's like, it just seems tone deaf at times when people are out there waiting for a small stimulus check to feed their family. When people are standing, right, in bread lines to try to feed their family, and you are fighting for $2 million, you know, that you deserve or not. So it's kind of, you know, it's very tone deaf. They do have to refocus. I understand. I firmly believe that players should be paid, you know, for their work, and should be paid, you know, for the risk that they will be taking out there to entertain all of us and to employ all of us. But at the same time, you don't have to put that in the public consciousness, because it just becomes completely tone deaf We're in the middle of a pandemic. Just get a grip, you know, focus on the correct things.
All right, Marley, great to talk with you. Always enjoy it.
Thank you, guys.
Wayne Kirby played 8 years in the big leagues, a lot of that with the Cleveland Indians, and now he's considered to be one of the best coaches in baseball. You saw him for years with the Baltimore Orioles, now with the San Diego Padres. Kerbs, you ready to go?
Yes, ready to go.
All right, let's start with this. I forgot to pay this off earlier in the week, but last week we had a question from one of our listeners who asked about what's the best way to break in a glove? There are a lot of different ways that you can do that, yes?
A lot of ways you can do it depends on the player. You know, some guys use two in the pink, some guys use three in the pink, and some guys use it the old traditional way, one finger out, all the fingers in the glove.
No, how do you, like, when you get a new glove, what's the treatment that you do with the glove? You did.
First thing I would do would turn it inside out because it's so heavy. I mean, it's so hard, and you want to loosen that leather up. So I would turn it inside out, work it inside out, then flip it back to its natural position, get Lexol, and tighten up the strings, and then play catch with it.
And you would do that. That's where I remember seeing guys in the clubhouses with, like, little hammers, right? Doing that, turn the glove inside out?
Oh, yeah, because, you know, right on the heel part is so thick and so heavy, right in that part. Some guys take them out now. I like to beat them in and go from there. That's what I like to do.
All right, I got questions for you about using your sense of humor as a coach. You were teammate of Albert Bell's. You were teammate of Manny Ramirez, Kenny Lofton. You watch Manny Machado, but I'm going to start with this, okay? One of my very good sources told me that you played against Charles Haley, who was inducted to the NFL Hall of Fame in 2015. You played against him in high school, and Charles Haley was 6'5", 252 pounds, probably a pretty good high school football player. Tell me about that experience.
I came across Charles Haley in the Virginia All-Star football game, and that was one day. That was one tough day. I came across. I was doing a dive play, and I saw a hole open.
So you were a running back.
Running back, and I hit that hole, and Lord Almighty, there he was meeting me. He met me so hard, and back in the day, we used to wear these bike helmets that you had to pump in. You had to pump, you had to, you know, put the needle on the top, pump it up, because it was air. And he knocked the air out of my helmet. I remember calling to the sidelines, my hands up, come and get me. So I ended up going to the sidelines, sitting on my knee. And I was just getting my helmet pumped up, but I remember that number. So every time I got the ball again, I wouldn't go to that side.
Now, your brother played in the NFL for a lot of years. I'm sure at some point you probably got a chance to stand on the sidelines for one of those. What was that like?
Ooh, that was unbelievable. The size, the speed, and I remember one game. And San Fran, they was playing Green Bay, and Gilbert Brown, I guess he's about 320. And he ran sideline and hit Steve Young. And Steve didn't see him hit him. And Steve ran it. They took Steve in the trainer's room. I could hear that collision going all day. And those guys up there don't play. They don't play. My brother said his first hit in the NFL felt like 4 years of all college.
I got to tell you that when I covered the NFL for 1 year, the New York Giants in 2002, and I walked away from that saying that every time there was a labor disagreement between the owners and the players, I was rooting like crazy for the players because I would see all these players coming back who had put in, 4 or 5 years. And they were so beaten up from that, you just felt for them. Because that sport, as you said, so fast and so big and so much punishment.
You're right. And the NFL players, I mean, they're getting lighter. They're putting lighter things on. I remember having a rib guard and all that. These NFL players don't wear knee protectors. They just want to be light and light and fast. And these guys, these linebackers, they're beasts. they hit. They don't hit. They hit through you. They want you to feel it. So, you know, kudos to my brother who played 11 years on that one.
So earlier in the week, I talked to Dino Ebel, who, like yourself, very respected coach. And I asked him a couple hypotheticals. I asked him if a player made a mistake. You know, the example for him as a third base coach was if a player ran through a stop sign and got thrown out at home plate, or, you know, didn't do something that he asked, how would he handle that situation? I ask you because you have a reputation of not only having a great sense of humor, but being very direct. How do you handle that situation? Right.
Well, to me, it depends on the player. It always depends on the player, his mentality. Can he handle it? Can he not handle it? I know starting off with Trey Mancini in the outfield, it was going to be plays that he dove on that didn't understand it. So I wouldn't jump on him. I'd say, you learn from that mistake. Don't let it happen again. But, you know, veteran players that understand the game, you know, it doesn't matter. You're hurting our team. I want to know, what were you thinking and the situation in the game. And I'll come after them hard. If they turn around and walk or walk away instead of listen to what I got to say, then it becomes a little more heated. And that's when coaches understand, because it's a respect thing. When a coach asks you a question, you know, don't just walk away, answer the question. That's a heated thing. And players understand what kind of coaches we are. We're passionate. You know, I'm a passionate coach. I love to win. I love to play the game the right way. And they get to know you in spring training. And if I see something, a bonehead mistake, I'm going to let the player know it was a bonehead mistake. Don't let it happen again. And the reason why I would say that is because it happened to me. You know, I did a bonehead mistake playing on the hard road. He took me in the locker room and took me in the tunnel and said, hey, I brought you up here because you're a good player and you can play defense. Don't let that bonehead mistake happen again. It never happened again. So, the situation of me, you know, I had a good one hop in right field and bobble it instead of going through the trail runner. I continue to go home. That was a bonehead mistake. So I learned from that mistake. Once you learn from that mistake, you pass it on. That's what I do. I pass it on. And, you know, I don't have any problems with players. Sometimes they, you know, I get to find out what kind of mood they in when they get to the ballpark. And then I go from there.
So tell me about Adam Jones and you always seem to have, you mentioned, you know, Trey Mancini, someone who left field wasn't his natural position, his first, you know, the first position that he played. On the other hand, Adam Jones, years in the outfield, and I'd be watching Oriole games and it always seemed like you guys had something going, giving each other a hard time in a good natured way. Give me an example of that with Adam, when you would have a conversation with him about, hey, what about this, or do it this way, or you know, tell me what happened.
Well, we always had problems, and as I would say to Adam, if anything goes wrong in the outfield, I'm blaming you. You're the center fielder, you're the captain, you're supposed to know where everybody's at all times. And it'd be situations where he's like, I've been in this league for 7, 8, 9, 10 years. I know what it hit. I know what this guy's playing. But what Adam don't understand is we're pitching him a different way, so I want him to play that way. You know, we didn't have the little pocket thing, the little, you know, the chart in our back pocket, and I'm doing our time. I was the one that had to remember where 12 guys hit the ball from 0-0 count to 3-2 counts, so outfield will move a lot. And I always tell outfielders, if you have an idea, you know, punch on your chest. And Adam will punch on his chest just to punch on it, and I would say no. No, no, no. And he would get mad at me. And I would still say, no, no, no. I got the final say. So we would always disagree with each other. I think he did it just to antagonize me.
And how would that carry over after a game?
Oh, it's the same every day. It was the same every day because I believe in having fun. I believe you can win, have fun, and do all the things you like to do. This is a kids' game, men playing it, having fun. I think when you have fun, you don't stress on the field. You got to have fun so you don't stress on the field. And you got to bring attitude along with it. You know, you watch Mike Trout. Mike Trout smile. Him and Mookie Betts smile more than anybody in the game. Bellinger. I watch them guys. All they do is smile. They go 0-for-1, and they still smile. And all of a sudden, before the game's over, they're 3-for-4. So they keep the same way. They're having fun every day. I mean, it's a tough game, but you still got to have fun at it. And me and Adam, I would try to have fun with Adam and the teammates every day. Something got to have fun. We got to have fun. We got to bring energy. And that's what we did every day.
It's funny you mentioned that. As you were talking about Trout and having fun, I was thinking, I'm sure you've been at least seen or read about the documentary The Last Dance. And it's clear in watching that, like, Michael Jordan was working himself into a frenzy, not liking people. And as you were saying that about Trout, like, Trout is hyper-competitive. Like, all of his teammates will tell you that. But at the same time, he has a blast. Or Michael seemed to need to get angry. It seems like Trout, it's part of the reason why I think players like him so much, because he's just out there like you were when you're 11 or 12 years old.
Exactly. I mean, you watch this guy, and, I mean, he's a bang-bang play down the first, and he'll turn around, and he'll be, like, smiling coming back. And it's like, all right, I got him. And you kind of wonder what goes through his mind. You kind of wonder what goes through his mind. He's human, but he's still having fun. I think that's why people, you know, attest to him. And it's like, look at this guy, man. He just went 0-for-4 in the same way because he knows he's going to come out the next day and have a chance to go 4-for-4. So little small things don't bother those players like that. They don't bother them.
Torrey Hunter told me about Trout. The thing that he loved to watch when, you know, Trout would hit a ground ball in the infield, he'd run to first base. And Torrey said if you watch behind him, it was like there was a rooster tail, like one of those hydroplane boats coming up of the dirt. It would run so hard, and the dirt would fly up in the air.
I mean, this guy runs hard. I mean, you don't hear him. You don't hear him. He got soft feet. He's just getting it. I mean, that's, you know, they said speed up your clock. For infielders, that's the guy you speed up your clock for. I mean, he's old school. He was taught the old way, run the game, play the game the right way. And, you know, wow, kudos to Torrey, you know, having a chance to bring this guy along because, you know, those young players learn from veterans like that. And, wow, he learned it.
Yeah, and Trout would be the first one to tell you Torrey Hunter was like the perfect teammate to have as he broke into the big leagues. All right, I'm going to throw names at you of players that you've been around and people that you've seen and been around. Albert Bell, you were a teammate of his for a number of years. What do you remember about Albert Bell, a story you like to tell friends?
Wow, he got so many. There's so many. We just knew Albert was a lawyer. I call him a lawyer. When he got, you know, away from the ballpark, he was Albert. When he got to the ballpark, he was a lawyer. He did everything. He had his own machine set up in case 2 or case 3, and it was all slider machines. He had to go in there. He had to hit 10 line drives to 6 feet high. He had to stretch by 30 seconds on a stopwatch. And when he came to the ballpark, he was a lawyer. He was Dr. Jekyll away, Mr. Hyde at the ballpark. He was intense and, you know, he checked stats every day.
Were you there for that moment when he got the nickname Mr. Freeze, which, as the story goes, as I was told, he liked to keep the clubhouse really cold. And other players maybe weren't excited about that. And so he and Omar Vizquel were having a disagreement about the temperature in the clubhouse. And Albert eventually, after a back and forth, turned it down and then took his bat and wrecked the thermostat.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. That was that was one of those things. That was one of those things. And you know, it was a few times he came in and not having a good at bat, not having a good at bat. We used to eat with plates. Now and when we first got into Jacobs Field, we ate with nice china plates, nice forks. That was gone one day. He came in after 0-for-4, and all the plates were destroyed by that. I think it's I don't know that Walker model bat he had. It was gone. So we ended up eating with paper the rest of my time there.
Speaking of that, a few weeks ago we had on Jason Grimsley, who gave us told us the great story about retrieving Albert Bell's bat from the umpire's room after it was confiscated when you guys were playing in Chicago. You were on the team at that time. What do you remember about that and how that went down in the conversation among the players?
It was like, you know, once they asked for that bat, it was like, this ain't going to be good. This ain't going to be good. And I remember Albert, he acted like there was nothing going on. He acted like there was nothing going on, man. I'm like, oh, I think something's going on. And we were just trying to find another bat that wasn't loaded. That's all we was trying to do. If we found another bat, I think it would have been okay. But, you know, we didn't. Only one used the Walker style bat was him and Sorrento, and wrong name.
Right.
Wrong name.
That's right. And that's how he got caught. Yeah, that's how he got caught. Yeah. When Grimsley switched it out, he took out the Albert Bell model bat and he put in a Paul Sorrento model bat.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you got to give us an A for effort. You help your teammates as much as possible. Things that people do in baseball.
What do you remember about the response to Grimsley? Because I love, you know, I got to cover Jason for a couple of years. He has such a great sense of humor. What do you remember about the response to him when you guys all found out it was mission accomplished?
We just became normal. We all stayed normal until, you know, at the end of the game. When I think John Hart came in and said, you know, the FBI is coming in and need that bat back. So he said, John said, we're going to leave out here for a second. You guys decide. They're going to come in, fingerprint everybody, because I think from the top of the ceiling, and I think if I'm not mistaken, Jason came down on a refrigerator, left his fingerprints on top. So they would have came up. It would have been a process, but they would have got to corporate.
Manny Ramirez, a young Manny Ramirez. I've heard from so many other hitters, like guys like Hanley Ramirez, because, you know, the media has one perception of Manny, and the stories here from other players is this is someone who is so smart when it comes to his approach with hitting.
Oh my Lord, when he was born, God, he reached down with his hands and said, this guy gonna be a hitter. You know, I watched this guy hit 3 home runs in spring training with 3 different bats.
Wow.
Like, this boy can hit. This is like in spring training, grab my bat, grab Omar's bat, grab Eddie Murray's bat. And I'm like, I'll hit home runs. I'm like, he can hit no matter what is in his hand. He just knew how to get the head of the bat to the ball. And, you know, he was a professional hitter. Professional hitter. If this guy had stayed straight, he's Hall was should have been future. I mean, all no doubt Hall of Famer. I mean, we pushed him, and you know, as some athletes always do, once they get that cash, they start slacking a little bit and forget to work, and all of a sudden they think they're going to stay 22, 23 the rest of their lives, and it don't happen.
I've had pitchers tell me they feel like that in their time in the game, these are Manny's peers, that he was the best breaking ball hitter that they ever saw. What do you think?
Oh, by far. He saw the ball way more than anyone else. I mean, he saw the ball. I mean, he could recognize a ball coming out of his hands, and he never committed to anything. I think he was just all ball. He just followed the ball. He didn't care about a pitch. I don't think he cared about a pitch. I just know if he tracked the ball better than anybody I saw, and he was able to unload and get the head out on it anytime. Breaking ball, fastball. I mean, he hit fastballs the other way. He could pull breaking balls. And his back covered the zone. It wasn't in and out. It covered the zone. I mean, you see some players with the same swing on the same pitch. No, this guy could slaughter away, could hit it away, could hit it out. Breaking ball in, could hit it out left field. He was something special. I mean, he continued to hit. I mean, that's one thing he continued to hit. This guy was could play defense. If he could play it, if he had stuck with his defense, he would have became, you know, MVP of the league easily.
Last one before you go. You were a coach to Manny Machado when you were in Baltimore. You're a coach to Manny Machado now. What's the most remarkable play that you've ever seen him make?
Definitely the backhand at third base, the throw he did. I mean, I didn't know he had that in his arsenal, but he came up with a play. He backhand and without even looking, just fling it. I don't even know how he turned his body and did it. I really don't. I still look at his video and I said, how in the hell he do that? So it was like, you know, I remember J.J. Hardy said, dang, man, I wish I didn't have to work as hard like you. I mean, his arm went from, if you look at this guy, he can throw from every angle. And you're like, man, I mean, it's like Dennis Rodman arms. But he's working, I don't know how his arm does it. But he make it look easy. He makes it look easy. I'm watching him in spring training this year, and I was like, hey, you're getting a little older. You still got it? He looked at me and looked last. So, but, you know, that's one thing. He keeps his arm going. He's, I think this year this year ain't over yet. He's engaged. He's at a different level, and Bobby's pushing him. And, You know, sometimes you got to explain to guys, just because you get a lot of money don't mean you should be the leader. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
Leadership will come. You'll know when it'll come. But don't just try to force yourself because you make the most money to be a leader. Everybody going to look up to you because you are the big dog. But it's how you bring it every day. You got to bring it every day. And then once people see you bringing it every day, then you'll separate yourself. And some, I mean, you're looking at a 26-year-old guy who's trying to be a leader to a new team. It don't always happen that way. It don't always. You look at all the teams, Derek Jeter, he was still the man, no matter how much money they give other people. When they came in, the Yankee Stadium, Jeter was still the man. So it's like Manny is trying to show that he cares and gradually become that guy. He will become that guy. This is the way you got to show it. You got to show running hard, show by examples. And in spring training, he was doing that. So guys are looking up to him, and I'm like, now he's showing your teammates you can go out and work out early. Now he's showing your teammates you go in, come in early, leave late. You're showing your teammates what they want to see because they're backing you and they're going to look for leadership because that team is young. Our team is real young. They're going to look for leadership from you. They're going to look for leadership from Kirby. They're going to look for leadership from everybody, from the coaches. But this is a young team. They're going to look for Haas, everybody, but it's a young team. So present yourself the right way and these other young kids will follow.
Curbs, I hope we all get a chance to see the Padres and other teams play this year. You know, we'll cross our fingers. I appreciate your time on this.
Okay, I appreciate you. Thanks, Buff.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Thursday. First up, not Doc Ellis, decidedly not Doc Ellis, at Matt Hotter on Twitter. My pandemic pastime has been rewatching the 1988 NLCS. Reminds me of how otherworldly Hershire was throughout. Why do we hear so much about Bumgarner's 2014 postseason and so little about Hershiser's? He was in four of seven NLCS games and pitched two complete games in the World Series.
Yeah, he was amazing that fall. Maybe part of the reason why is because I'd feel like such a fanboy if I talked about it. That was like the last year I was a fan before I started covering for professional baseball. I grew up a huge Dodger fan. And you're right, Hershiser was unbelievable, finishing that regular season with that consecutive inning streak of 59 innings without allowing a run and then having that amazing postseason. I think there's a chance we're going to be hearing from Mr. Hershiser soon. I'll just leave it out there that, we're probably going to have a conversation soon on the pod about Orioles' great run through the 1988 postseason.
There you go, not Doc. Portland Maverick at the Battered Bees writes in, Buster, I was at Candlestick and saw Cliff Floyd hit an absolute bomb on a frozen rope that went most of the way to the top deck. It seemed like it only took a second to get out. What are some impressive blasts you've seen in person?
A unique home run. Daryl Strawberry, when I was covering the Yankees in 1998, he pinch hit for Joe Girardi while they were playing in Kansas City early in the year. And the wind was absolutely blasting in from straightaway center field. And Daryl, at that time, they didn't have the outfield setup that they have now. But he hit a ball so far straight through the teeth of that wind for a grand slam. In those conditions, I couldn't believe he hit the ball that far. A few years ago, Gary Sanchez, when we were doing a Sunday night game against between the Yankees and the Red Sox from Fenway Park, he had a home run in Fenway that it was the loudest sound when it hit that tarp, advertising tarp, that was above the Green Monster. And I remember being shocked by that. But maybe the most impressive home run, Mike Piazza off Ramiro Mendoza. I think this was in 99 or 2000. It was like, Taylor, he had a two iron. This thing went so far. I think it went out of Shea Stadium and like bounced amid this tent that was out there beyond left center field. It was, and the next day the New York Post had a picture of him in mid swing. It was impressive how far he hit that ball.
Love a ball that leaves the ballpark. Last one for today. Debbie Gammons Brown writes in, if you could go to a game with anyone, dead or alive, famous or not, who would it be?
Debbie, no doubt Abraham Lincoln.
Nice.
Like Abraham Lincoln is my favorite figure, in history. I was a history major. My stepfather's name, his last name is Lincoln. And so from the age of seven, I became very ingrained in anything about Abraham Lincoln. I would love to go to a game with Abraham Lincoln, not only to quiz him and all those history events, historical events that he was involved in, but he had such a wry sense of humor. I'm sure that he would have great observations about a baseball game. That would be really fun.
Nice. And I'll keep it real here. What about just your friends and family right now? Just to go to a baseball game with your pals? That would be nice at this moment in time.
Well, I would say this, that all of my family members have no interest in going to baseball game. Like, none of them like baseball. None of my siblings do. My stepfather, I've said on the past that none of them are even on televisions.
That's amazing. Okay. Well,
yeah.
I'll keep that one for me then. That's Bleacher Tweets for today. Thanks for writing in.
That's it for today. I'm thanks to Curbs and to Marley and to Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.